This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Another day of deadly Israeli strikes on the Gaza Strip as the regime wages its campaign of bombing the coastal territory. Gaza child amputees as it increases since October the 7th. Resistance reprisal as they respond to the attacks by the Israeli regime. Welcome live from Tehran. You tune into World News. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, it's another day of deadly Israeli strikes on the Gaza Strip as the regime wages its campaign of bombing the coastal territory. Gaza's health ministry says 250 Palestinians have been killed in 24 hours. That brings the Palestinian death toll since October the 7th to more than 23,000. Some of the latest Israeli attacks have hit residential buildings in Khan Yunis and Dar al-Balah, as well as locations in Rafah, killing dozens of people. Israel has been bombing hospitals, schools, supply vehicles, and even UN-run facilities indiscriminately. According to Gaza health officials, Israeli drones bombed the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital on Sunday in an attack that targeted, quote, anything that moved. Meanwhile, displaced Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip are facing hunger, thirst, diseases, and more Israeli bombings wherever they go. Some 59,000 Palestinians have been injured since the start of the Israeli onslaught. Every day in Gaza, more than 10 children on an average lose one or both of their legs as a result of Israeli air and artillery strikes. That's according to the international charity organization Save the Children. The organization has cited statistics released by UNICEF saying over 1,000 children have had one or both legs amputated since October the 7th. Many of them lost their limbs during operations carried out without anesthesia. That's because Gaza's healthcare system has been grappling with major shortages of medical supplies and staff over the past 3 months. The report by Save the Children illustrates one of the impacts of the Israeli onslaught on children's lives in Gaza. A British-Palestinian plastic surgeon who has been in the Palestinian territory describes the onslaught as a war on children.
With 10,000 children killed so far in this war, almost 1% of Gaza's children's population, it felt like a war on children. It felt like every day you would see more and more of these kids being brought in. And this is just the physical injury, not the mental health injury. And a lot of these children had, in addition to the injury, have lost families, have lost parents. We had, at one stage at Shifa Hospital, 120 kids who were the sole survivors of their families on multiple generations and were wounded and had no one to look after them.
Abu Sidha said children made up half of his operating list every day, adding that they have received devastating, life-altering injuries due to the Israeli attacks. He said the number of patients coming in per day at the time of his service in Gaza was beyond anything he has ever witnessed. The British-Palestinian medic gave evidence to London's police war crimes unit on his return from Gaza. He is set to offer his testimony on Israeli crimes at the Hague-based International Criminal Court. Meanwhile, Israeli forces have abducted dozens of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank as the regime continues its atrocities across the Palestinian territory. Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandu brings us more.
This morning alone, 40 Palestinians were arrested by the Israeli forces. The majority had been detained in Ramallah, Qalqilia, Nablus, Al-Khalil, Jenin, And Al-Quds, this means almost all the cities in the occupied West Bank. Not only during the raids, the Palestinians are being detained. Palestinians are being detained at the numerous military checkpoints because following the Israeli genocidal war on the Gaza Strip, Israeli forces had erected and set up numerous military checkpoints in addition to the already set checkpoints between the cities and the areas. For example, for the last 2 days, the Israeli forces had closed all the entrances and the exits of the Ramallah city and Al Biri.
A senior Hezbollah commander has been killed in an Israeli strike on southern Lebanon. Wissam Hassan Tawil was the deputy head of the Elite Radwan force of the Lebanese resistance movement. He was murdered along with another Hezbollah fighter in an attack on their car in the village of Majdal Selm. Areas along Lebanon's southern border have been the scene of intensified fire exchanges between Hezbollah and Israel since the regime began its bloody onslaught on Gaza back in October. Hezbollah leader Said Hassan Nasrallah has repeatedly warned the Israeli regime against launching a full-scale war on Lebanon. Meanwhile, Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah has hit an Israeli military base with a barrage of rockets and missiles. The group says the attack was a preliminary response to the regime's assassination of a senior Hamas leader inside of Lebanon. We took a closer look at what happened during our explainer program. Let's take a look.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Explainer. I'm Gisu Mishah Ahmadi. Hezbollah has attacked an Israeli military base in what has been described as an answer to Israel's targeted assassination inside Lebanon. Hezbollah's attack was swift, precise, and sent a strong message to Israel of Hezbollah's capabilities. Now, this is how Israel's targeted assassination went down. An undetected drone that pinpointed a second-floor apartment in southern Beirut, a combination of a Hermes drone and Nimrod missile, the intended target and casualty, Saleh al-Aruri, a former leader of the Qassam Brigade and a member of the political bureau of Hamas. Hezbollah's Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah vowed retaliation, and he did in a big way. 62 missiles of various types were fired at Meron, a vital Israeli military post. Hezbollah called it a preliminary response. So what types of missiles were used? It is not really known, but most likely consisted of a combination of some of the missiles that a snapshot of Hezbollah's firepower, most notably rockets like Fateh 110 and Fajr 3 and Fajr 5 missiles. The question that needs to be asked here is, where was the Israeli deterrent, like the Iron Dome missile system that is meant to deter missiles from contact? One possible scenario, Hezbollah diverted the Iron Dome with drones or maybe missiles or a combination of both, although this cannot be proven and it's just a theory. Ever since October 7th, Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, Israel and Hezbollah have been targeting and trading fire along the border. This is the area and the approximate location of their military equipment and personnel. Heavy military assets on both sides, as you can see, from tanks to drones to fighter jets, and of course, a large cache of weapons and missiles. The result from the Hezbollah side: 670 operations against Israel over the past 3 months, 48 border sites and communities targeted more than once, with over 2,000 Israeli casualties and 4 Israeli civilian deaths. Israel's figures, however, are always underreported. Meanwhile, Israeli attacks number around 230, with 145 Hezbollah fighters killed. The civilian death toll is around 30, which clearly shows why Hezbollah has retaliated so often. Since we're on the borders, this is the border area between Israel and southern Lebanon. It is called the Blue Line, established by the United Nations in the year 2000. It forced the departure of Israeli troops from southern Lebanon after an 18-year occupation. Recently, Israel announced that it was Hezbollah to withdraw beyond the Litani River in southern Lebanon to reduce tensions, as Israel said, after the targeted assassination. Of course, that is highly unlikely. And finally, the Philadelphia Corridor, or the Philadelphia Route, a border area between Gaza and Egypt. Israel has said it wants to take control of this area. Israel's reason, quote unquote, it must be in our hands to ensure the security that Tel Aviv desires.
Meanwhile, the situation remains volatile along Lebanon's southern border, with resistance movement Hezbollah and Israel exchanging fire. Early, we were joined by our correspondent in southern Lebanon, Mariam Saleh, who brought us more.
The new developments concerning the Israeli shelling of South Lebanon, we do have a direct targeting of a mosque in the border town of Abbasiyeh. And we know that there is a lot of damage that has been done in this mosque. It is partially destroyed. And that is the latest concerning the Israeli shelling. We also have in the town of Taibeh, which is not a bordering town, but still has been the subject of heavy Israeli shelling, where the Israelis actually targeted the supplies of water and electricity, all the necessities, the civilian infrastructure in that town and other towns as well, not only in that town. But of course, the Israelis are also somewhat going beyond the boundaries. We did have a couple of days ago another attack on the area of Kawthariyat As-Siyad. Perhaps there, Israelis are saying this was a false alarm. It was an empty factory, actually, a cement factory. And so it seemed that the Israelis had wrong intelligence that perhaps there would be Hezbollah fighters in that area. That didn't seem to be the case.
Well, Iraq's Islamic Resistance has staged fresh attacks against the U.S. and Israeli interests amid boiling anger at U.S.-Israeli genocidal onslaught in the Gaza Strip. The Islamic Resistance, an umbrella group of the Iraqi resistance groups, says it has performed a drone attack on the U.S. Ramallah and military base in northeastern Syria. That follows another attack by al-Nujaba resistance group against an Israeli site in the city of Haifa. The Iraqi resistance faction says the raid shows the resistance axis would never give up on its strategic goals in the region. A spokesman for the group said the objective of the resistance is to disrupt the U.S. plans in the region and to neutralize efforts of the Israeli regime in Gaza. Resistance groups have carried out attacks against U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria, as well as Israeli cities, over the past weeks in response to the genocide in Gaza. Yemen says the United States is framing Ansarullah movement's operations at the Red Sea as a global threat to turn attention away from the Israeli massacres in Gaza. An Ansarullah spokesperson made the remark after the U.S. Secretary of State warned Yemen against further attacks on Israeli-bound ships that Anthony Blinken claimed, quote, are hurting people around the world. Mohammed Abdul Salam hit back by saying that the U.S. continued support for Israel could explode the region. He also warned against militarizing the Red Sea after Washington said it is leading a coalition to patrol the waterway. Abdul Salam said that the U.S. and its allies cannot prevent Yemen from more operations against Israeli-destined ships. Yemeni armed forces in solidarity with Gazans have launched missile and drone attacks on vessels operated by Israel or those heading to the regime's ports. And the Italian foreign minister says a group of seven industrial powers working with the Israeli regime to find what he called a rapid way to end the devastating war on Gaza. The seven-member body includes the United States, a major accomplice of Tel Aviv regime in the carnage raging in Gaza. Antonio Tajani suggested, quote, joint forms of pressure on parties involved in a conflict to limit the number of Palestinian casualties. He also emphasized putting pressure on the Israeli cabinet to end military operations in Gaza. Meanwhile, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is on the third day of his Middle Eastern tour for a so-called push to resolve the conflict, now entering its fourth month. Blinken has met with leaders of Turkey, Qatar, and the UAE to emphasize preventing the spread of the conflict. This while last week, U.S. Congress approved its latest multi-billion dollar aid package for Israel amid its massacre of Palestinians in Gaza. Iran's foreign ministry says the January 3rd terror attack that killed 91 in the southern city of Kerman proved that terrorism is a pervasive threat for global peace and stability. The ministry's spokesman, Nasser Kanani, made the remark during his weekly presser. Kanani said there is no such thing as good or bad terrorism. The spokesman added that fighting against terrorism requires the complementary use of the security and intelligence capacities of regional countries. He hailed Iran's security and intelligence cooperation with countries inside and outside of the region. Kanani also condemned the January 3rd attack, which was claimed by Daesh terrorists. He said Daesh is created by non-regional intelligence services. Kanani also noted that those using terrorism for their sinister purposes are accountable for the crimes committed by the terrorists. Well, an international conference dubbed Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the defender of human rights, has been held in Tehran. Participants discuss how the anti-terrorist icon fought against injustice to uphold human rights in the region. Gisu Misha Ahmadi brings us more.
Shedding light on different aspects of the martyred commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani's illustrious career. Prominent political figures and academics gathered in Tehran to take part in the first international conference dubbed Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, Defender of Human Rights.
Western countries claim to be advocates of human rights, but they are the ones who created the Daesh terrorist group. On the other hand, it was General Soleimani who fought and defeated this terrorist group. He was the one fighting to bring back peace and stability in the region. In practice, he was the one defending human rights.
The resistance front that Haj Qasem created has done great service to Muslims. Americans created Daesh. They even supported the terrorist group in different ways. And this terrorist group was on a mission to tarnish the image of Muslims and Islam. But Haj Qasem confronted them, he fought against them, and defeated the terrorist group to show to the world that the true face of Islam is a religion that seeks peace as a fundamental right that all humans must enjoy.
Head of a special committee formed to follow up on General Soleimani's murder case from legal and international aspects explained that the legal proceedings are more than just a means of seeking justice.
These legal proceedings are an opportunity for international public opinion to familiarize itself with General Soleimani and to understand the true effects of foreign meddling in the region. This is not just an opportunity to seek justice for Haj Qasem, but also to enlighten people worldwide.
The speakers reiterated that the U.S. claims to be a staunch supporter of human rights. Yet the top commander, who defeated the notorious Daesh terrorist group in the region, who clearly violated the most basic human rights, was assassinated by the U.S. This reveals the true colors of American politicians as they use their version of human rights to advance their political agenda.
The participants of this conference believe that the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani as an anti-terrorist icon in the region proves that the concept of human rights the way Western countries have defined it needs to be revised. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
And with that brings us to the end of this Worldness edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's violent siege of Gaza has led to chronic food shortages and skyrocketing prices, forcing Gazans to go hungry. Now 50% of Gaza is at risk of starvation. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. The Electronic Intifada wrote, before October, Sabrin Yassin 48 would buy half a kilo of yeast for $1.40. In late November, she was taken aback when the seller demanded $11 for the same amount. She said, "This is 8 times what I used to pay. Having yeast at home is equivalent to having gold nowadays. We have resorted to baking without yeast for over 40 days due to its scarcity and the steep increase of its prices. Due to the Zionist regime's closure of its boundaries with Gaza since October, food is scarce in Gaza Strip. People primarily depend on the aid provided by the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA. Sabrin has 6 children and her husband Jamal, formerly employed as a school maintenance worker, is their sole source of income. He earns around $330 a month, half of which is used to pay their mortgage." She said, "We used to live in Absan al-Kabira in Khan Yunis, southern Gaza. But on November 11th, we were forced to leave for the city center in Khan Yunis after the Israeli army bombed our house. Tanks later approached the center of the city of Khan Yunis and the Zionist regime carried out massive bombardments of the area," she said. "On December 5th, we were forced to flee to the Al-Hawuz area in Khan Yunis. When we arrived, the UNRWA schools there were full. Displaced people can register their names at UNRWA schools to receive aid, but due to overcrowding, Sabrin and her family were turned away," she said. "We had our mattresses and sheets, but we were told by the UNRWA staff to leave. They rejected adding our names to the list of aid beneficiaries. Sabrin spent 2 days on a street next to the Mustafa Hafez School in Khan Yunis, hoping she would be allowed in, but her efforts went in vain. 2 days later, their friends offered them shelter in their apartment," she said. "We lived with 13 other people. We had no access to drinkable water or food. 20 people shared a single small bathroom. We could not clean after using the bathroom, as we only have water once a week." Sabrin continues to struggle to secure food for her family. Due to her refugee status, she used to receive food aid from UNRWA every 3 months. It consisted of flour, milk, lentils, and cooking oil. After October 7th, UNRWA started providing food aid to everyone, regardless of refugee status. At the beginning of the war, Sabrin would visit an UNRWA facility in the Asana area and receive aid, though she said it was often chaotic with no clear aid distribution method. She said, "I went there 3 times, leaving my house at 5:50 a.m. to be first in line, but displaced people already lived there, arriving before me. Each day, they closed the facility at 1 p.m. She said, "I went back home empty-handed. After days without flour, Sabrin went to the shop on mid-December. She said, "I go as early as possible because the food is gone by midday. Typically, a 25-kilo bag of flour would cost around $8. Now, it was nearly $50, an impossible price," she said. "I tried to negotiate the price with him until two other men approached. The men continued to outbid each other until one paid nearly $200 for the bag of flour," she said. "Only wealthy people can afford this price. Their willingness to pay whatever the retailer asks, sometimes even more, has led to a significant increase in prices, leaving us, the poor, struggling." Groups of starving people have broken into UNRWA warehouses in Gaza, taking flour and other supplies. Eight trucks have also been stopped by people in need of food. "People are stopping aid in trucks, taking the food and eating it right away, and this is how desperate and hungry they are," an UNRWA official told reporters, according to Reuters. Sabrin said that locally, aid groups have provided trucks of flour to the neighborhood mayor to guarantee fair distribution of flour. "They provided families with 6 to 8 members, like mine, with 3 bags of flour." Later on, she received only 2 bags of flour and was so told that there was a flour shortage. "Sabrin has learned to ration out the family's flour precisely," she said. "I bake once every 3 days, providing a portion of 4 loaves per individual over that period. I encourage my children to eat 1 1/3 loaves per day." She said it is difficult for her youngest to restrict their food intake. "They are hungry," she said. "Instead of starving for 2 days, they starve 1 out of every 3 days. Salma Ahmad, 27, was displaced from the Al-Nazla area of northern Gaza to the southern city of Rafah. She is mother of a 2-year-old child and has felt the impact of rising prices. A can of milk for her child cost $5 before the war. Now it's nearly $7. She said, "I visited a pharmacy to buy one and it happened to be the last can. However, at that very moment, another man offered around $27 and the pharmacist sold it to him." She said, "All I had at that moment was $13. I intended to buy both milk and diapers for my baby, who is suffering from malnutrition." Kamil Mohanna in Khan Yunis, who runs a grocery store, said that the food shortage is due to the closure of all crossings with the occupied territories called Israel. He said, "The Zionist regime's division of Gaza into north and south has brought the transportation of goods between the Gaza Strip's governorates to a standstill. Wholesalers sell to us at high prices, so we have to charge people even higher to make a profit." He said that people are now in survival mode and will pay whatever they have to for food.
Ocean of Dua.
Allah. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll adopt a thematic approach towards supplication, and we'll have a look at supplication from the point of view of different verses of the Holy Quran, and we'll also have a look at some parts of the transmitted supplications as well as the whispered prayers. So stay with us. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajil farajahum wal'an alahum ajma'in. Brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we were discussing the different constituents of supplication. As we previously mentioned, there are three constituents for supplication. The first one is the attraction, the kind of neediness and acceptance which is the reality of supplication. The second constituent is the supplicant, and the third one is the mad'uv, the Almighty Allah, the one who is invoked. Now, regarding the first constituent, as we were saying, we said that the ones who understand the reality of supplication, they are the ones who have understood the state of indigence in themselves in the very first place. So, they are the ones who call the Almighty Allah in all states of their lives, not just in the state of being in despair or being distressed or in the state of being influenced by afflictions. No, they always remember the Almighty Allah, and it seems that they always are in state of iltirar. Now, the supplication is the attraction between the Creator and the servants, which is by itself a kind of worship. That's the point. Supplication is a kind of worship, and it is one of the best kinds of worship. This supplication is revealed to the servants, and we do not have to wait for the supplication to be responded. There have been numerous scholars who, when in the process of supplication, thought on nothing else, and since they saw themselves as God's servants who were given the privilege to engage in supplication, they carried the order out and got busy engaging in supplication. In this process, if their supplication were answered, they saw it as another asset that God has bestowed upon them. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, لَقَدْ دَعَوْتُ اللَّهَ مَرَّةً فَاسْتَجَابْ. Once I invoked Allah and my supplication was answered. وَنَسِيتُ الْحَاجَةِ. But I forgot my need. لِأَنَّ اسْتِجَابَتَهُ بِإِقْبَالِهِ عَلَىٰ عَبْدِهِ عِنْدَ دَعْوَتِهِ أَعْظَمْ وَأَجَلُّ مِمَّا يُرِيدُ الْعَبْدِ. And why did I forget what I needed to ask for? This is because Allah's response to His servant when invoking Him is greater and loftier to Him than achieving what the servant wants. And this is the fact that we have mentioned once before. There are two kinds of acceptance in supplication. Only one of them is the very need, is the very request of the servant. But the first one is acceptance, because you are allowed to talk to your Lord and ask Him anything. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam says that Allah has inspired to him by saying, مَنْ شَغَلَهُ ذِكْرِي عَنْ مَسْأَلَتِي أَعْطَيْتُهُ أَفْضَلَ مَا أُعْتِيَ السَّائِلِينَ. One who is busy with mentioning me and at the same time forgets his need, I will give him the best that I have ever given to the supplicants.
I remember when I first met Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo kashti ab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ab kamju tishnagi avar bedast. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. Ta beju shad ab az bala va past. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy of God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good, about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
There are also other traditions regarding this first constituent of supplication, dear listeners. We also read in the traditions, إِنَّ الْعَبْدَ لَتَكُونُ لَهُ الْحَاجَةُ إِلَى اللَّهِ فَيَبْدَأُ بِالثَّنَاءِ عَلَى اللَّهِ وَالصَّلَاةِ عَلَى مُحَمَّدٍ وَآلِهِ حَتَّى يَنْسِي حَاجَتَهُ. Sometimes it happens that a servant needs something from Allah, and then he begins praising Allah and praying Him to bless Muhammad and his pure progeny to a degree that he forgets what he needs. He somehow forgets what he came to ask the Almighty Allah in the first place. And the tradition continues, فَيَقْضِيهَا مِنْ غَيْرِ أَنْ يَسْأَلَهُ إِيَّهَا. But Allah achieves his need without being asked for it by this servant. This is the kind of Lord that we must recognize and realize. Imam Sajjad alayhi salam invokes Allah by saying, إِلَهِ فَاجْعَلْنَا مِمَّنْ هَيَّمْتَ قَلْبَهُ لِإِرَادَتِكَ. O my Lord, make us among those whom you have made their hearts submit to your will. وَاجْتَبَيْتَهُ لِمُشَاهَدَتِكَ. Make us among the ones whom you have chosen to see you. وَأَخْلَيْتَ وَجْهَهُ لَكَ. Among the ones whom you have attracted their faces towards yourself, towards you alone. وَفَرَّغْتَ فُؤَادَهُ لِحُبِّكَ. Whom you have emptied their hearts except from your love. وَرَغَّبْتَهُ فِيمَا عِنْدَكَ. Whom you have made look forward to what you have. وَقَطَعْتَ عَنْهُ كُلَّ شَيْءٍ يَقْطَعُهَا عَنْكَ. Make us from among those whom you have cut off from everything except yourself. This means that we must be thankful to the Almighty Allah, to our Lord, to be giving us this chance, this advantage, this privilege of being able to supplicate to Him. And this is the reality and spirit of supplication. That's why we have said so far that supplication is way beyond spiritless words. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye. Guide me all the way to your Jannah. Yeah, Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you throughout my life.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English Radio.
Shahid al-Quds.
Part 5.
Just before the year 2019 was over, a notable incident was the Israeli regime's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, escaped from the Palestinian missiles. These images showed a glimpse of the concentration of power in the Gaza Strip, and it was enough to send a direct message to Israel on how much the resistance had improved. Fingers of accusation directly pointed at Qasem Soleimani. He had supported the resistance and played his role so the resistance could reach this stage. All of this happened after he managed to impose a great change to the region by reversing the collapse of Syria and Iraq. The Israelis saw these changes as a threat that would trap them in a fire belt, while Soleimani had envisaged the start of the tensions in the region. Less than 3 years after the Arab Spring, the developments led countries towards chaos. The United States and Britain sought to use it as leverage to uproot the resistance movements. The organized terrorism by Daesh in Iraq and Syria topped the major events. The Egyptian nation that had dismantled Hosni Mubarak's government entered a new phase after Mohamed Morsi claimed power. In Palestine, the resistance received its share from the backfires of the developments. After the 2012 war and the developments in Egypt, the siege was tightened to take the country to an uncertain future. Concurrent with these developments, Haj Qasem started to patch up the ties thanks to his military contacts. Parallel to these developments, the resistance forces' military power should have been regained and the lessons should have been learned from the 2012 war. In the beginning of 2014, the relationship saw a big improvement in its quality. Haj Qasem and Mohammed Daif, the commander of the Al-Qassam Brigades, established a direct contact. The Quds force delivered weapons to Gaza within days. Some of the consignments reached Gaza, but some were intercepted. Hence, establishing ties with Haj Qasem reached the executive stage. In the new phase, The tunnels were also constructed and expanded. From the humanitarian aspect, the siege on the Gaza Strip was tightened, and Palestinian prisoners held in the regime's jails went on a hunger strike. So the option of taking Israeli captives for a prisoner swap was on the agenda again. On June 12th, the Al-Qassam Brigades tried to carry out an operation in order to take an Israeli captive for a prisoner exchange, but the Zionist settlers who were on their radar were killed, and the operation ended in failure. On July 2nd, Zionist settlers killed and burned Mohammed Khadiri in Shuafat. Resistance forces reacted to the criminal action with firing missiles. On June 8, 2014, things spiraled out of control. The Zionist regime staged another military attack with the goal of destroying the tunnels that belonged to the resistance forces.
حماس أضربهم ضربة قاسية بعمل حجم تدمير كبير جدا وإيش بقدر أحقق بالمفاوضات لمصلحتي كإسرائيلي وهي مصري حيساعدني وما يترتب بعد هيك حيعمل كي وعي شغل حماس بأنفسها الحصار حيستمر أكثر وحيكون أكثر شدة
أخ المسؤول عن إدارة العلاقة وعن الملف في فريق الحج اتصل يسأل شو الوضع وإحنا قلنا له هاي معركة والحج بيعرف شو معنى المعركة وشو حاجاتنا في هذه المعركة.
But anyways, resistance forces' missiles reached Tel Aviv once again. The Israeli forces received painful strikes on the ground as well. The media affiliated with the Palestinian factions recorded them. Two operations, namely Zakim and Nahal Oz, were proof of the quality the tunnels had reached. During the war, the Palestinian resistance unveiled the level of development it had attained. Gaza was entering a new level of conflict, and the signs of Soleimani and Iran were conspicuously evident in those battles. The steadfastness in the 2014 war provided a historical opportunity for the resistance movements and their allies, although there were many hardships as well. The battle once again made a distinction between those who really supported Palestine and those who were serving the Israeli interests. The outcome of the war was assessed. They decided to start a new phase so the occupied West Bank would be one of the areas of activities for resistance movements many years after the Al-Aqsa Intifada. On July 31, 2015, Zionist settlers set the Dawabshe family's home on fire while all members of the family were inside. It sparked the third Intifada. The Intifada was dubbed the Intifada of Knife. Under the shadow of all these developments, Haj Qasem Soleimani met with various Palestinian groups in February of 2016. Fingers of accusation pointed at the meetings. Yet, Soleimani managed to forge reconciliation between the Palestinian groups.
Ladies and gentlemen,
the incident took place simultaneously with U.S. presidential elections. Donald Trump assumed the presidency after those elections. Trump entered the White House while he had a plan to help normalize ties between Arabs and Israel, the political deal of the century. A few months later, Ismail Haniyeh was picked as head of the Hamas Political Bureau. Soleimani sent a congratulatory message for Haniyeh. In October of 2017, the deputy leader of the Political Bureau of Hamas traveled to Tehran. By holding constant workshops with the Al-Quds Force, it was possible to transform to a new qualitative level and shape the Palestinian resistance movement. Before holding that workshop to expand the weapons, Donald Trump imposed some changes in the region. On December 6, 2017, he recognized Al-Quds as the capital of the Zionist regime.
I am also directing the State Department to begin preparation to move the American embassy. It is time to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital.
But Soleimani had his own views on what was happening. A few weeks after the speech by Qasem Soleimani on the Land Day, some rallies were held towards Gaza. The rallies were known as the March of Return. The Palestinians turned to innovative moves like flying incendiary kites and balloons. After a few weeks, the U.S. Embassy was relocated to Al-Quds.
Today, its embassy opened here.
It triggered protest rallies across the world. At the start of 2019, the resistance movement's capabilities exceeded the so-called deal of the century. That year was the peak of the resistance capabilities. Israel once again resorted to the military option.
On November 12, 2019, the Zionist regime targeted two top commanders of the Al-Quds Brigades, the military wing of the Islamic Jihad.
Baha Abu al-Atta was a commander of the Al-Quds Brigades in the north. He was martyred after his house was bombarded by shelling. At the same time, Akram al-Ajudi's residence in Damascus was also hit in another bombing. Although the top commander of Islamic Jihad escaped unscathed, his son was martyred. Soleimani made a phone call to extend his condolences. Saddest day in Iran since Imam Khomeini, God's blessing upon his soul, passed away. Millions of people swarmed the streets of the Iranian capital, Tehran. They were filled with both rage and grief. Qasem Soleimani was assassinated. Neither the leader or president nor any other state official delivered a speech to the crowd.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.